Hello, my name is Gar.
And I'm Eric Fontenot, if you want to know.
And you're listening to what we call...
Shooting the Shindig.
Yes, shooting or shootin'.
Yeah, I write it shooting, but I say shootin'.
Shindig, it gets an SH sound going, that sh sound.
Yeah, well, that's what I like about it, is it's got the SH at the beginning of both words, and it's got the G at the end. When you
now,
write it.
Speaking of SHs, our friend Eric was talking about typing on the BlackBerry.
I was telling Gar, so I hate touchscreens. I always have. You know, it always reminds me of when I was a kid in the 90s or whatever, and your mom would tell you not to put your fingers on the television screen or on the computer monitor or on the windscreen of the car, the windshield. She'd be like, no, don't put your fingers on there. You leave smudges. It's the oils or whatever. Then you'll clean it, you know.
Now that's all we do.
And that's all we do now. It's like, I wouldn't, if I was over at a friend's, I wouldn't touch all over their laptop or something or all over their screen.
Right.
But then you do that with your phone, and then, but it's also the screen you watch it through. Hate it. Getting my nasty fingers on the touchscreen, which then becomes very nasty.
Right.
Despise it. So what I was telling Gar is that I think two phones ago, I had a BlackBerry Priv. I was telling Gar, yeah, we all think about BlackBerry, like the old school BlackBerries in the late 90s, early 2000s that had the...
Remember those?
The keyboard and
that
the trackball. You'd play the Brick Breaker on there, and businessmen had them.
Brick Breaker!
Yeah, Brick Breaker. I love Brick. It's basically Arkanoid.
It's fun
or
to save. Brick Breaker. Brick Breaker.
Yeah, is that what the BlackBerry one's called? I get those confused. Anyway, it's the same game. It's the pad. It's one-sided Pong where you're trying
to break.
But
when you would type on the BlackBerry...
I prefer the physical keyboard, yeah. So the one that I had was a smartphone made by BlackBerry. It was like a normal smartphone, but it would slide up and you could type on the keyboard. And I like that better because, you know, your thumbs feel out where the J and the F are like your fingers do when you're typing at a keyboard.
Flip phones are coming back. Did you know that?
Are they?
Yes. Motorola.
But like regular flip phones that aren't smartphones?
Yes. They're smartphones.
Well, then they're not really flip phones.
But they flip.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, I mean, that's just a change in form
factor.
It's
aesthetically nice. The flip phone was so nice because it felt good when you talked on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
It had the screen. They weren't smart then. They are now.
Well, smart just wasn't an option then. I mean, it's not like it was a stylistic choice that the flip phones chose. That just wasn't a thing. Computers weren't small enough for that to be possible, really.
Right. But I think that the old aesthetic is more appealing.
But that's what I'm saying. Instead, that's just a matter of form factor.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, when people say flip phones, they don't mean just about the flipping or whatever. They're talking about like a period of phone technology.
I was watching the last season of Better Call Saul.
Oh, yeah. I haven't.
And what's really interesting about that is everybody in that show has a flip phone.
Mm-hmm.
Because
well, it takes place.
Takes place before there were smartphones. And
yeah.
I thought that was, what a nice touch, because I'm thinking, oh, that's kind of cool. They all have flip, but it makes the flip phone look so much better.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and a lot of people watching it, not everyone, of course, there are people younger than me watching it, of course, but a lot of people watching it remember that time period. You know, I remember flip phones. You remember flip phones.
Yep.
You know. But, I mean, it's good that they did that. I don't know that they deserve that much credit because that's just... It was set in that time. It would be oddly anachronistic if they just had smartphones and, you know, like, you know, iPhones and whatever, you know. Sorry.
Yeah. I used to enjoy the show Gotham because they mixed up technology.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd see like an old CRT and they talk on flip phones or they, you know, but they were all from different eras.
Right.
But that was the appeal for me. The art director chose that as the aesthetic, and I thought it worked really well. It contributed to the gothic feel that show had.
Right.
My objection to that show, I loved it until the last season. And that they had declared that was going to be their last season, or the network declared that. So they had a lot of loose ends to tie up. So they tied them up really fast and haphazard. So the last season was awful. It just ruined the whole thing for me overall. And I kind of wish that they had been able to tie up the loose ends over at least two seasons.
Mm-hmm.
Because it all felt like, okay, and then so-and-so goes with so-and-so, and that's it. Okay, and then these two, they, you know, it just... Felt too rushed.
Now, did they only have a single season contract? Was that the deal, or they just weren't?
I don't know. They went on for like what? 4 years, 5 years, something like that.
I don't remember.
And as I say, I loved it when it was on. And yeah, the last season, they just said, okay, that's it. I think they were on Fox.
Yeah.
So Rupert Murdoch likes to just say goodbye. Okay, see you later.
See, like a rushed final season that still ties things up is better than having a cliffhanger final season where it was like, oh, they thought they were going to have another season to.
I'd almost rather that because then they could revisit later.
They could, but that doesn't necessarily happen. No. And if it does, it usually does not live up to the original, you know, because it's a different group of people. Writing to a different
I don't know.
Time.
There's enough nerds that would go, oh, we want to really see it all tie up, or we want to see some kind of conclusion.
Yeah, but then they usually fuck it up, is what
well,
I'm saying.
Well, that's what happened. With the last season was they fucked it up.
Right.
It made me feel like I was a sucker for liking what happened before.
Well, I mean, you can separate the two. You can appreciate what it was before the final season.
But I have to take the naivety into account.
Mm-hmm.
I'm naive of what the show is going to be and what it's going to turn into. Oh, I'm pleasantly surprised. That was how it was.
Yeah, but I mean, the way that you felt about it in the first, whatever, two or three seasons, whatever it was, isn't a lie just because of how the final season turned out. You know what I mean? You still think about that. You don't have to write that off just because of what ended up happening. They didn't plan for it to happen that way. It's not like they were like, oh, yeah, you know how we'll get them. We'll do two or three good seasons, and then we'll just screw it all up and squeeze it together in the end.
No, they didn't do it on purpose.
No, of course not.
But it's like you said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's better than having cliffhangers that aren't resolved.
No, but I'm saying,
and
yes,
in some ways,
yes.
I'm going, yeah, it would be better to have cliffhangers unresolved than to have that ending, that way of tying everything up. It felt tied up.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't allow enough breathing room mm-hmm. between things that are tying up, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like, okay, we're tying this up and this up and this up and this, you know, all at the same time. And it just felt rushed.
Again, I think that this speaks to the problem of multi-year television is that there's no guarantee that you're going to get however many seasons.
True.
And so sometimes you do have to rush the final season because you want to finish
That's
the
only
vision.
If you've got an episodic kind of
well yeah that's what we're talking about with television
bleach, you know then you've
I mean that's true of films too if you're going to have a film series
but there are shows that all tie up within each show
right
okay this mystery is solved this villain is caught you know it's not ongoing like Gotham
oh
was.
yeah well but those are effectively two different media right
correct.
you know in the same way that like a novel and a play are different you know having something that's going to be episodic and distinct versus having something that's a longer form storytelling. I mean, really, those are opposite ends of the spectrum because an individual episode of a show is shorter than a film, and so that's shorter period storytelling. A season of a show, let alone multiple seasons of a show, is longer form than a film.
Correct.
So, you know.
But if you're going to have it that way where it's an ongoing story rather than just a series of stories with the same character.
Right.
A show like Gotham.
Yes.
Needs to have a reverent tie-up of loose
right.
ends.
But my saying is that you don't have any guarantee for number of seasons. And so if you only have one season left to tie up all your loose ends, and that's too short of a time.
Right.
Or if you think you have however many more seasons, and then you find out partway through a season, like, oh, you're not being renewed. And so you're like, well, I got to tie this stuff up now in the back half or the back three episodes or something.
Right. They did that with Wonder Years.
They did that with, you know, I mean, that happened with a lot of shows.
It was like, okay, we're done.
Yeah.
Whereas I would rather they just say, okay, we're done.
Yeah. Well, with a show like Wonder Years, you might as well just say, okay, we're done. It doesn't matter that much.
It did to me because they had to tie up the characters, Winnie and
mm-hmm.
Kevin. You know, I don't know. It just, again, that was last season of Wonder Years felt rushed.
Oh,
it's like,
yeah.
Okay, and they told all the writers, okay, this is our last season, so tie everything up.
Yeah, see, I feel like with Wonder Years, you actually could have gotten away with not totally tying
Correct.
Everything up.
You could have gotten away, that show, you could have gotten away with.
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
Without that last season, yes.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. No. Or with the last season just being the same idea as the previous season, just sort of leaving things, whatever.
It's not like Gotham, where it was everything was a cliffhanger, you know, like what's going to happen yeah. with these characters, you know, and it was only those questions. And the same thing with like Breaking Bad, you know, it was the same thing where you tune in every time to find out, okay, what's going to happen
next? Oh, yeah,
next?
Yeah. Breaking Bad was great, though, because they did get to sort of set their time frame and they did get to, you know, Breaking Bad ended fine because
Well, Gilligan said that he didn't want to be at a Hollywood party and have to tell everybody, oh, yeah, I do Breaking Bad. And somebody say, oh, is that show still on?
Oh, yeah,
He said he didn't want to have that. So he wanted to make sure that everything was tied up. But he had the freedom to do it in his way, and it worked out
perfectly. With however long he felt he needed, because it caught fire.
I think that's my issue with it, you know, is having everything breathe.
Yeah,
you know?
But the thing is that there's a degree of freedom there that not everyone has, and there's also a degree of vision that not everyone has.
Correct.
Vince Gilligan and his buds knew what he was wanting to tell and had a good sense of how much space he needed to tell that story.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then didn't feel pressure to keep it going. And that's great. In fact, that's the ideal, but not everyone gets
that amount
of freedom.
That becomes
or has that amount of talent.
The great thing to pay attention to if you're a writer or if you're the producer or director of a show to figure, okay, how do we start this show? How do we end this show? Everything else is just the in-between. That way, you'd never have that problem. You say, this is how it's going to end, and you make that part in your negotiation. It's going to take two seasons or one season or whatever, and then say it's going to happen this way, and you tell the writers so that the writers don't feel encumbered by, oh, we got to get this done. We got to figure out something, you know, quick, you know.
Right.
It's rather, you know, just takes its time and...
Yeah, and I would say that is more of a producer or executive realization. But the problem with that is that with an episodic show that goes across several seasons, you know, if it's three seasons in and the show has never caught fire and isn't turning a profit, you're not going to do it for the next four seasons that needs to tell its story. So there is...
Well, there's redemption, too. Like, okay, we could really pull him in.
Sure, but what I'm saying is that if things aren't going well, it's understandable that then you wouldn't keep the show going. Even if, you know, it does have some, you know, if it's not turning a profit, if it's not getting
What I'm saying is, like, if you start a show, before you've done the pilot or whatever, you just say, I have the start of the show and I have the finish of the show. It doesn't matter how many seasons we run. One, two, three, four, doesn't matter. This is the ending.
Right. But the thing is, you might need, you know, you might need more than one season or fewer than seven seasons to tell that story, and it depends.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm saying it doesn't matter how many seasons being in between. You have the start, you have the finish. I'm, like, really hip on this idea.
Uh-huh.
Writers, if you're out there, come up with a show, do the beginning and the ending, and sell it on the fact that you can have as many seasons as you want. This is going to be the beginning, this is going to be the ending. You know, the ending is going to be the two people get together or whatever, or the villain is vanquished. Everything in between that gets written with that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, bear in mind, the ending is going to be this. And you say that to the writers. And you come up with some shows that I think would be interesting because you're unencumbered. But we know how this is going to end. We know how this began. We're good. We're good to go. And let's meet, you know, all the meat in between.
I don't agree. I think that, I mean, I agree with the premise. I don't agree with the conclusion. I think that a show that's going to, with a certain ending and a certain beginning, it's going to last 10 episodes or 24 episodes or 72 episodes are by necessity different because of the number of episodes you have to tell the story. It makes the story different.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that's not. Yeah, it's
so
sure.
I'm saying that if you have a beginning and an ending and it doesn't matter how many episodes, it does matter how many episodes because the story is different.
If it's a good show, it keeps you, the audience, compelled to watch. I have to watch. I have to see what happens. I'm not saying that. You can go for as many seasons as you want, you know? This is going to be the ending regardless, you know?
I understand, but if you write it for 72 episodes and then you only end up with 34, and then you have to get to that same ending you had in mind in fewer episodes than you expected, it's going to feel rushed. Even if you came into it knowing what you wanted the beginning to be and what you wanted the ending to be.
Think so?
Because... Yes, of course. How could it not be that way?
Well, I see how it could not be that way.
If you wrote for a 72-episode span
right.
for the first two seasons, so you have 24 episodes or whatever, let's say, and then in the third season, you're thinking you're going to go for five more, you're only going to get to go for one more, then you're gonna it's going to feel rushed because you're trying to get to that final part and you thought you had 50 episodes to do it and you, in fact, only have, you know, 10 or whatever. It's going to feel rushed.
I'm figuring the final part is the last season.
Right, but if you think that the last season is the seventh and it's in fact the third, it's going to be different, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so
no doubt.
And so if that expectation changes partway through the production process, it's going to feel rushed or it's going to feel stalled, I guess. If you think that you're going to have three seasons and in fact you got to squeeze four more out, then you're gonna it's gonna not feel very slow.
Not if you said the ending is going to start with this. These mm-hmm. two people are having this conflict that needs mm-hmm. to get resolved by the last episode.
Right.
Because of whatever happened before. We don't know what happened before, but when you get to the beginning of the end, it's going to be these two people or these three people, whatever, in this situation, and it has to be resolved, and it gets resolved by the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't matter then what the other seasons were. They all know that per season, they could reach a conclusion that would be that.
Okay, so now you're talking about something different. You're not talking about a beginning and ending of a show. You're talking about a beginning and ending of a season. And this,
you'd have to every take season. That into account. That's why I would say.
Okay,
yeah,
but that's not what you said. You're saying I have to take that into account, but you didn't say that. So how could I possibly take that into account?
Writers would know that. I would tell them.
Yeah, but whoever you're trying to tell this thing to doesn't know that because you're not saying
I
it.
Would tell them, we don't know how
you're
many
seasons. You're saying one thing and you're implying something else.
We don't know how many seasons is going to go.
Yeah.
So here is the idea for the first season.
Yeah.
Here's the idea for the last season. Write everything in between and have every season for season two, season three, season four, end in a way that could then melt into that last mm-hmm. season.
Right.
That's brilliant. Take that idea and use it. That's a great idea. That allows for a lot of freedom. See, here's the thing about being artistic, is you can say, okay, I'm artistic, so I go everywhere all at once. Well, the way it works is there is limits and boundary lines and all that stuff that are set by the artists themselves. I expect my painting to look like this. I expect my songs to sound like this. It may be wrong in the bigger context. That becomes another issue. It's like, do you want to communicate or not? But within that, there is limits that it's kind of like a game where you could say, okay, the goal is to get the ball from here to the goal for both sides, and then don't have any rules. What makes the game is the rules, is okay, you're not allowed to do this, you can do that, and that's life in general. And if we have limits and boundaries, it helps to organize our world better. You know, the problem becomes, how do you define those lines? And for an artist, you're defining those lines, hopefully, if you're thinking about what you're doing. It doesn't need to even be conscious. It's just kind of like, okay, this is how I expect things to look. And your aesthetic then becomes your art. Then it becomes whatever limits you put on yourself are just as important as the explorations. It's a yin-yang situation. And if you get the balance right, you make great art. You know, and it's true of all life, isn't it? It's true of everything in this world. You strike the balance. The Buddhist way is the middle way. Life is gray. It's not black. It's not white. And you understand that, and life then is not so daunting. It's, okay, I meet somebody, and they have dark and they have light. Can I handle their dark if I really like their light? My ex-wife used to tell me the parable about the wolves. You have two wolves in you, the black wolf and the white wolf. Which one are you going to feed?
Mm-hmm.
And that's so simple, but it's so accurate. Anyway, got off on that. Okay, so what were we talking about?
Television?
Television! A Baird Man! Television!
Al Pacino.
Television changed America.
Oh, it did. It changed so many factors of... I mean, it changed probably not just America.
I live in an area where MGM was. David Selznick Studios was. It's now Sony. And that was the big boy. That was the biggest boy in the field. And during the 70s, they finally had to concede to television. What had happened was Universal Studios had started tours in the 60s, early 60s, and it saved their butt, and they started getting involved early in television. The other studios, not so much, and they suffered for it. In the 70s, there was a big fire sale of all kinds of stuff from the MGM studios. It was all stuff that you'd look at today and you'd spend millions of dollars, but stuff was going for hundreds of dollars and thousands of dollars. And people would go, who would want the ruby slippers from Wizard of Oz? There were 8 pairs made. They're now almost priceless. And they were all that crap was sold by MGM during the 70s, Scarlett O'Hara's dress. Somebody went, oh my God, somebody paid whatever it was, $1,000, $2,000 for that? Why? You know, I don't think they even paid that.
Now, now that would be a cheap price to pay for the same item.
Well, you can't touch it now. So anyway, they sold out, you know, because television was taking over. And it changed the movie business. Later, what happened was there was a move in movies towards what were considered new and more radical directors and changed. When the ratings came in, they were able to change Hollywood from a homogenous, you know, it must conform to these standards to there could be different standards. So there's G-rated and M-rated. Then it was a mature audience before PG. And R-rated and X-rated, of course. And so that allowed a lot of latitude for the new directors to, you know, Scorsese and people like that to push the boundaries of what film was. So in a way, the studios going down created a new kind of cinema. You had then the spaghetti westerns that were done in Italy and with Clint Eastwood. And
done by Italians in Spain.
Yes, The Dirty Dozen, and that was a Peckinpah film, Sam Peckinpah. At the time, it was considered really violent. You would never have that violence in films. Bonnie and Clyde. Later, The Godfather, when they shoot Sonny, and everything's in slow motion, the bullets hitting his body and all that stuff. You would never see that. You hadn't seen that before, and of course, sex was in there, too. Huh. Yeah, so by the 70s, and then you had a very, what would you call it, robust ex-film business. And it was film. It was stuff like Emmanuel and, of course, the famous Deep Throat and Behind the Green Door. And those movies, it was the movies that my parents would go to in secret. You know, we went and saw that secret, that movie, that Linda Lovelace movie. You know, they would tell their friends or whatever. Oh, yeah, we went and saw that, too. You know, it was the same time when people of that age were sequestering themselves at parties into a bedroom to smoke marijuana. And it's just so cute and quaint now. But it was like such a, ooh, look what we're doing kind of a thing. You know, we think of our parents as one way. But, you know, as far as my parents, we were all living in L.A. and things were going on. There was a live sex acts on stage on Sunset Boulevard. I remember as a kid, you know, driving past there and going, whoa, what's going on there? And that was before any restrictions on, I guess, that kind of a thing. I think there's probably many restrictions to that. But it was people trying things out. And a lot of that had to do with the big studios falling and television becoming the norm. You know, people were advertised to in a way they had never been advertised to before. The baby boom generation was advertised more than any other generation prior and was all for toys and stuff they could con their parents into buying them. And it was the spoils of war, so there was a big, big middle class. Huge middle class.
Well, and back then, the country invested in the working class, invested in America. You know, the highways, works. The GI Bill. Yeah, yeah. People look back at the 50s and say, oh, it was so great. And then they misidentify why it was so great. Of course, it wasn't great for all aspects of American society. Absolutely. Absolutely. And they think like, oh, yeah, it was great because the black people weren't uppity or whatever. No, it was great because...
But to be fair, it did give rise to the Civil Rights Act.
Correct, for a bad reason. It gave rise to the Civil Rights Act because we needed the Civil Rights Act because black people weren't getting their fair share.
Absolutely, but yeah. It was done.
It was done, and it was important. And, you know, I always tell Gar about how important LBJ was in that.
He was. He was extremely important.
He got it done.
He twisted arms for that.
He did, you know. And he was somebody who was kind of a racist himself. He was from rural Texas. But, you know, he would say things like, you know, because the Democrats were concerned about the civil rights because it was going to turn off the solid South who had voted Democrat since the Civil War. And
why do you think the Republicans have been pushing so hard in the South? They're now the dominant.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's the Atwater. That was the Southern strategy. But, you know, people said to LBJ at the time, it's like, listen, if you push for the civil rights stuff, we're going to lose the South for a generation or more. And he was like, if you can't do something great while being president,
right,
then what's the point of being president?
That's what he said. That's what he said. Yes.
Yeah, that's not a direct quote, but it was that.
No, it's not direct. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway,
what's the point of being president if I can't do any good?
Yeah, I don't think that JFK would have had the courage or the gumption to get that done.
But wasn't it within his administration that those wheels in motion?
No, he was putting it off. He was hoping to not have to deal with that.
Who was pushing him?
People. So some people in Congress, yeah, you know, and the civil rights movement and all the press around that, you know, the country was changing, you know, people were being like, we can't be having this. You know, it was starting to make people feel uncomfortable because the sentiments had changed. But JFK was a shrewd politician. He didn't want to, you know, maybe he didn't have a lot of conviction. I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't think that JFK was that great of a guy. Anyway, LBJ, on the other hand, after already taking over for JFK, not being, you know, it's kind of a mixed position for him because on the one hand, JFK was so well beloved and so you could do a lot of stuff with that legacy. On the other hand, people think that you killed JFK and so you have to, you know, there was some whatever.
Yeah.
And so, because, you know, the Civil Rights Act he pushed through before the election of 64, you know, like, I mean, politically, not a good idea, you know, like, I mean, LBJ bet on civil rights because
he
believed
in what they said, you'll lose the South.
Exactly. And then in the 64, that was the, you know, we were talking about this before with Richard, you know, that was the realignment, you know, you had Barry Goldwater, and Barry Goldwater won Arizona, his home state, and then four deeply Southern states that had never not voted for Democrat, you know, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and South Carolina. And that sort of set the, you know, that's why people like Lee Atwater and Reagan, I guess, if you want to give him any, and the Bush people, you know, people like that sort of leaned into that Southern strategy.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, LBJ knew what he was doing. He knew that ultimately the South was going to abandon the Democratic Party. He thought it was more important to do the right thing, even if, again, he was a little bit reluctant because he didn't like black people that much himself, but knew that it wasn't right.
Well,
you wouldn't do that nowadays.
He also saw a bigger picture, a much bigger picture than himself.
He did. He did. I mean, he also did the Great Society.
I think that's why I admire him.
I admire him.
Because he saw in the bigger picture beyond himself.
He was a deeply flawed president. You know, the stuff that was going on in Vietnam was really terrible.
Tet offensive,
you know, a lot of really bad stuff happened in LBJ's presidency in terms of that more than any other presidency. But that said, the seeds had been sown long beforehand. It was really started in Eisenhower, you know, helping French into China and then all that sort of stuff, and then really ramped up under JFK. JFK probably the most responsible in terms of policy. Of course, the most, it was at its worst in LBJ's presidency for the longest period of time. You know, if you wanted to hold someone most accountable for death, then that would be LBJ. But in terms of policy, that was really started under Eisenhower and really ramped up under JFK. And then, of course, you know, wrapped up with Nixon. I don't want to miss out on the chance to shit on Kissinger.
Yes.
My mother, I think I've told you this story before, Gar. My mother, I remember when Bob Dylan was getting some sort of like lifetime achievement Nobel Prize, whatever. My mom's not a huge fan of Bob Dylan, was like, oh, you know, I don't know about this, whatever. And I was like, I mean, Bob Dylan's good, whatever. I don't know what I said about that, but I was like, fuck the Nobel Prizes. I don't think they're worth a whole lot because of, you know, various people who've gotten Nobel Peace Prizes. Well, first off, I mean, awards are dumb. And then people have gotten Nobel Peace Prizes, which
are not
made
peaceful.
Yeah, we're not peaceful. Make it a joke of it. And I said, somebody. And I said, and Henry Kissinger. And she's like, I like whoever. I wish I could remember. She's like, I like so-and-so. And I like Henry Kissinger. And I was like, Mom, what? You know, because she doesn't know. I mean, she just thinks of him as being an intelligent guy or whatever. And, you know, hadn't really given a whole lot of thought. Was a, you know, child, a minor during the Vietnam War. I was like, oh, my God, Henry Kissinger is.
I was a minor during the Vietnam War.
You were. But you've probably given it a little bit more thought over the years than my mother has. I'm not trying to shame my mom. My mom's a smart lady, but, you know.
But it's not been a secret. I mean, there's been books about Kissinger. There's been
a
movie about him
not being the nicest
of guys.
No, yeah, I'm not on the cutting edge here. I mean, I think it's plain as day. It's just that, you know. And, yeah, they gave a joint prize that year, whatever year it was, 73 or whatever, to Kissinger and then the commander of the North Vietnamese military forces. And that guy turned it down because he said it was a Nobel Peace Prize. And he said, he said, there's no peace in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, so had more, I don't know, self-awareness or humility than Henry Kissinger did, who gladly went and accepted it, and, you know. Yeah.
Did he die?
Last I checked, he was still alive.
Okay.
So, I mean, but he could die at any time, so. But when I checked about a month ago, he was still alive.
Well, there you go. Only the good die young.
Exactly. Someone I know used
Billy
to say...
Billy Joel!
Billy Joel. No, as someone I know used to say... The evil keeps him alive.
It does. You make jokes about Burns
mm-hmm.
on The Simpsons about that.
Exactly.
Germs do a Three Stooges factor inside Burns' body.
We're just talking about...
stuff. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, we're not even really having a conversation. You and I are... commenting.
All right, we need to get our friend Richard, who's going to come and talk about being a slut a little later. In fact, I need to find out what the hell is going on with him.
Yeah, and then once you do that, maybe we can get ourselves a second round.
I see what you're...
No rush, though, because I also was enjoying that water, and I will pour myself a second glass of water regardless of the booze situation.
Yes, booze. I said, "Hey, where'd you go?" He's probably whacking his willy.
Yeah, he's whacking his willy. Well, that's okay. I mean, you know, we're not in a... It's still... The day is still relatively young. And eventually...
That's Boswick.
No, eventually Boswick will come by.
And that'll be it.
That'll teach us a lesson.
That'll be a party then.
Oh, yeah. He's having a nap.
He's having mass.
I said he's having a nap. He might be having mass. I don't know.
He might be having a nap. Or, huh?
Hello, this is Richard.
Oh, yeah. Well, whatever. Anyway, it's not a big deal.
Oh, I'm mad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's another thing with getting old, is I don't have anger anymore like I used to. And that's a good thing. It's very low stress.
It's freeing.
It's freeing. Yes.
Anger is a lot of work.
But it's not that you don't get angry. I get angry, but it dissipates and goes away. I don't dwell on it.
Yeah. Well, as I always tell you about honking the horn, if I see somebody being an asshole, I'll get mad and I'll honk my horn and I'll turn if I have a passenger and be like, "Do you see this guy?" And then I move on with my life and forget about it.
Yeah.
I don't care. I don't care. I don't get mad. I'm not going to chase anybody down. I'm not going to be sitting there at night, be seething, be like, "Oh, that guy cut me off. Why?" I don't care.
Speaking of that, that's what starts the whole show of Beef.
I haven't seen Beef. You've mentioned
it
before.
It's wonderful. It starts like, what if road rage carried on, like in a whole revenge scenario where one driver is getting revenge on the other and the other driver is getting revenge on them, and it's to the point of ridiculous, but it's a really engaging story. I really enjoyed how they put it together. And it wasn't too long. You know, it's episodic, but it was like meant to begin and end. It was, it began well. It went all the way through and ended. It was like, okay, it felt like the end, not rushed. I think that's the benefit of streaming. You could say, okay, we're going to have 8 shows, or we're going to have 10 shows, or 20 shows. You know, they probably don't want to hear, "It can go on forever," kind of a thing now, I would imagine. I don't know. You know, that was the hope of network television, was you'd have a show that would go be so successful, it would go on for years and years, and the more years it went on, the more they could charge the advertisers.
Yeah, but also, the more years it went on, usually the worse it was, because they had not... The people writing the first season weren't thinking, "Ah, yes, a 7-season show."
Well, they did their best.
No, of course they did, but I'm saying if the vision changes, then there's a variation in the flow of the story, right? If you're expecting a longer term and then you have to wrap it up suddenly, then you can get whiplash of too fast of a show. If you're expecting, or if you're just writing for like, "Oh, let's just get this season done," and then you get renewed for like several more seasons or whatever, all of a sudden the show's got to stretch and jump the shark and whatever, because it's like, okay, let's just keeps going on. You know, The Simpsons has been on for 32 seasons.
Well, to be fair, there have been shows that have gone way too long before there was streaming. You know,
absolutely.
Too long.
It was much more of a thing before streaming. As you were saying, you know, nowadays, you know, I mean, some streaming shows do just keep going on and on, but generally speaking, it's sort of marketed as a package of however many seasons, and then they do it, and then it's done.
Yeah. Yeah, and the benefit is you can binge watch. You watch to the end.
Well, it's done with that. I mean, that's just part and parcel of streaming, and so it's made with that in mind.
Yeah, and when you think about it, that's a big difference from network television.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that the nature, in many ways, in terms of timing, in terms of subject matter, in terms of just process of screenwriting and filmmaking, you know, there's a lot of differences between network television and streaming shows, you know, even if they are both ostensibly under the same banner. They're almost, you know, they are in some ways different media or different genres or whatever.
Well, the thing is, we can now look back and go, oh yeah, this way is much better. I mean, it's great to be able to watch YouTube or
yeah,
watch a show that's not cable or, you know, just watch a show when it's convenient to do that.
There are pros and cons to both, but I do think that overall there's a lot of benefit to the Netflix and the YouTube and the whatever in terms of, I don't know, a lot of things. In terms of being able to binge it, in terms of being able to set, to define.
But then you get so many people making so many shows.
Mm-hmm.
And on networks that nobody's necessarily going to have. There's winners, Netflix as a winner now.
Sure.
Hulu and some of that. But then you've got lots of other channels.
Right.
I kind of like that because... But it's generally stuff that's in copyright. It's not copyright protected.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, the Superman cartoons that were done in the 40s by the Fleischer brothers are not copyrighted. So there's tons of, not only streaming, but they used to show up on VHS and then later DVD, Superman.
Mm-hmm.
It was a company making money off of, there were like a couple of Popeye cartoons and
mm-hmm.
something else. So whatever they got on there was not copyright protected. So they would just sell it as a compilation. And this is our thing.
Right.
Oh, got off the subject.
I mean, we just changed the subject and we can go back to network versus yes. Netflix or earlier than that.
Back in my day.
Back in my day. Back in Gar's day.
Yeah, actually, back in my day, there was three main channels. Channel 2, Channel 4, and Channel 7, which were
ABC,
CBS,
NBC, and
correct.
CBS. The
yes.
big three.
Yes. And then we had local networks. So we had KTTV, and what was the other one? So Channel 5 and Channel 11, KCOP. That was Channel 9, I think. And those were all local, and that was when there wasn't total corporate control of media.
It was inherited from the radio system. I mean, ABC and NBC and CBS were what they were because they were big radio conglomerates. And then things like KTTV, that is a radio call sign, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, old PBS stations when I was a kid were still.
Those were PBS. Then we were PBS stations.
I'm not saying they were, Gar. I'm just saying that the PBS stations when I was a kid, that their television stations all had radio call signs because they were also radio stations. It was in some ways a throwback at that point, but that's how it used to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes sense when they're both broadcasting.
Absolutely. So,
of course, the telecom industry moved into the frontier of telecom.
Yeah. So everything became one.
Mm-hmm.
And then became more homogenized to, like, okay, we have these top-rated shows that we'll show that reruns of, and not that they didn't do that before, but it was more local, of course. Money went came locally. Yeah, and then there was PBS, and that was always Channel 28.
Mm.
You'd have to find that on the UHF channel. And that was a whole other thing, is UHF. Yeah. That's all gone now.
Yeah. Well, the industry has changed.
The industry has changed, and that's sort of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Because now with streaming, how do you compete? KCOP, you know. That's how technology changes things. So the technology of television changed movies. And not only movies, but radio as well.
Mm-hmm.
People were not as compelled to listen to radio when they could watch something.
But it's funny because the pendulum has shifted somewhat because podcasts are just the modern form of radio. It's an audio-centric format. And a lot of radio stations nowadays, I mean, you know, of course, most prominently NPR, but other radios as well, do it in podcast form. additionally, and then you can just listen to that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, you know, it's funny how these things, because, you know, 15 years ago, someone would have been like, radio's a dying medium, or actually, I guess now probably 20 years ago, radio's a dying medium, and it's done, and that's the end of it. It's like, okay, yeah, sure, that makes sense. And it's like, oh, wait, but now there's podcasts. That's just the same thing.
Right.
Different technology. The format's, yeah, the technology's different. And it's a streaming version. You know, it's kind of like what we were talking about earlier with streaming television shows versus network television shows. Radio, where it's instantaneous and what contemporaneous, versus like being able to listen to like, oh, yeah, you know, I listened to the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from, you know, May 2020 or whatever.
It's format. It's different format.
Yeah, it's a different format.
Same thing, different format.
Yeah, and so the binging is a thing there, too. You can just listen to, like, several episodes of, you know, whatever show you like on NPR or whatever radio station, your local Minneapolis station or whatever.
Well, we were joking earlier about keep those cards and letters coming in. That was what the local TV stations would do.
Oh, yeah.
So you keep those, you know, so that their ratings would be up.
Mm-hmm.
And they would base it on that.
Of course.
Yeah, when I was, I don't know, early teenager, there was a show called Bowling for Dollars. There's somebody mad outside. Oh, this guy. Okay, so I have this neighbor has a very loud car and a very loud voice.
Why?
Because you're a hot rodder. He has this very loud car, and he has this parking space. And anybody that blocks that parking space, he yells at. Because he wants to get in. He wants to get in now because we've got things to do. Anyway, his car is very loud, so when he leaves, you always hear him. And I think he takes great delight in setting off car alarms.
Well, he just has to show you how massive his schlonger is.
It's so silly. It's so primal and silly.
I find it hilarious if I don't have to be involved. If I can be a fly on the wall like I am now... it's hilarious. It's such a laugh.
Human folly.
Yeah. Again, this goes back to what you were saying earlier, Gar, about don't hold on to anger. That guy is not happy. He's a not happy dude.
Well, yeah.
You'd be so much happier if you just let shit go. You could have waited 10 seconds and let that other car pass, and then you could have moved in. You
didn't have to. For me, it was not knowing that everyone's life has ups and downs, mm-hmm. turmoil and triumphs, you know, and everybody has that. Some more than the others or whatever.
The feeling
but knowing that, you know that everybody somewhere hurts.
Of course.
And, and it's kind of our duty to soothe that in other people, not to... Because then it sends bad ripples if you poke at it. You don't want to poke at that stuff. It sends out bad ripples for the rest of the world, and that becomes the world you have to live in.
The feeling you're describing, Gar, is the one called sonder.
Sonder.
Yeah, that's the word for that. The thinking about the feeling that you get when you think about the fact that everybody that you meet has a whole complexity of feelings, you know, a whole iceberg of life all to themselves. You only see little interactions. That's called sonder.
Marley, what's going on?
I don't know.
You ran away. Come over here.
All right. A couple of crazy dogs, man. You're a crazy dog.
These dogs.
All right. I need to find out where that Richard guy is, because now I'm starting to get mad. Okay, and this is Gar saying good night, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, and bye from Eric. Hey, Gar, where can they look you up online?
GarStudios.com, of course.
Yeah, and are you also on the Instagram and the Twitter and the YouTube?
I am.
Check him out.
And you can find my Bandcamp, too.
Oh, yes, your Bandcamp, Gar Montalbano. That's G-A-R-R Montalbano.
M-O-N-T-A-L-B-A-N-O.
Yes, indeed. All right. And I'm Eric, and good night.